This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We really appreciate you taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with us live, feel free to scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. Paul right there is standing athwart the quarter deck, ready to welcome you on board. And if you have any observations you would like to share during the course of the show or some questions you would like for us to address to our guest, that's the perfect place to be there. We will both be monitoring during the course of the show, and we'll be glad to bring your conversation into today's show, which for the regulars here on Midrats, and I know some of y'all have been with us since the very start back in 2010, our guest today, you're going to recognize because we were looking during the pre-show, and for over 11 years, we've been honored to have a recurring guest at least once a year come on to talk about something that we joked a few years that nobody else wants to talk about Russia, but by golly, we are. And, you know, here we are in 2022, and history has returned to one of her favorite playgrounds that she likes to make history at. And so today, it's a great opportunity with the war waging in Ukraine and with the retreat around Kiev and the repositioning of troops to the Donbass region is transitioning to a new phase, that we bring back on returning guest Dr. Dmitry Gorenberg, the senior research scientist at the Center for Naval Analysis. Dmitry is here as our guest, speaking on behalf of himself and not necessarily speaking on behalf of any institutions he may be associated with. Dmitry, welcome back to Midrats.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we really appreciate you coming back on. I don't know if you've been on here long enough, you get to be called the official guest host or not, but you're a double digit, so I think you're getting close. And as the listeners didn't hear the pre-show, but one thing we just chatted about a bit on the pre-show is back when we were pups back in the day, in the late 80s, early 90s, at the end of the Cold War, there was very serious institutions, very serious programs with serious individuals doing some heavy intellectual lifting in the area of Soviet studies, Russian studies that it transitioned to. And that really started to dry up. And I know we both know individuals who they got their PhD in Soviet studies in 1992, and all of a sudden all the opportunities kind of dried up. And the world kept marching on, but the importance of the Russian Federation, the former Soviet republics, some of which are now members of NATO, hasn't really drifted away. And we've all seen once the invasion of Ukraine popped up, a lot of people were looking for experts in the field of study. Others were contemplating why, whether it was in Europe or in the United States. People were surprised, shocked, or had trouble understanding. And just thought I'd take advantage of having you here today. You know, talk for a little bit about the state of, back when we were kids, it was called Soviet studies, now Russian studies, both academically and in some of the organizations that help advise and shape policymakers as they move into governments and institutions that are given the charter to keep an eye on this important part of the world.
Yeah, well, you know, I think as you just indicated, in the 90s, I think there was a bit of a shift where, you know, in the Cold War days, there was a big focus on the foreign policy aspects and the, you know, U.S.-Soviet relations and that sort of thing. There was, in the 90s, and I was very much part of this, there was a big shift to focusing on Russian domestic politics and of the other, you know, former Soviet states as well. But really, you know, a lot on Russia, where people were interested in the elections that were happening there, how the, you know, politics were evolving. I was studying at the time in the 90s, I was studying minority nationalist groups, you know, that sort of thing. So there was this, whereas the foreign policy side, I think, got kind of, you know, fell by the wayside because it wasn't seen, you know, Russia just wasn't seen as a big player. And so we had that shift through the 90s and you know, in the 2000s. And then it started coming back, the foreign policy side and the security and military side in the last 10 years. And so you see, you know, more funding, more positions for that kind of thing. And when I started studying the Russian military pretty seriously, probably back in when they started doing the reform, so 2008-2009 kind of time period. And there weren't a lot of people in the U.S. who, you know, at least in my age group, there are a few like older people, you know, close to retirement age at that point, who were, you know, doing Russian military. And, you know, after 2014, after the first invasion of Ukraine, the annexation of Crimea, that you really saw that picking up. And, you know, now there's, you know, a bunch of experts, you know, young people and, you know, some older people who've kind of come into the field. And so it's really an area where there's been a noticeable return in focus. We'll see if the funding opportunities return as well. As I mentioned in the pre-show, a lot of the foundations kind of in the 90s and 2000s got away from funding area studies at all, not just Russia, but any area studies, and started doing other things. And I'm not sure yet, you know, they may not come back. They may, or maybe different foundations will come back. But I'm thinking, you know, like the Ford Foundations and MacArthur's, those kind of people, they kind of got out of the field. Carnegie's still left, so we'll see. But that's kind of, you know, I think there's definitely a need for that kind of investment. So hopefully it's not just the government doing it.
What is, as you're looking at Russia these days, and as we all are, what got into Putin? I don't know the right way to ask the question, but what drove this attack on Ukraine? I mean, this is beyond the 2014 takeover of Crimea, but is this him trying to put the gang back together?
I don't think not in a kind of simple way, you know, like I don't think this has much to do with reconstituting the, you know, the Soviet Union or the Russian Empire or something like that, in terms just straight up. I think it does have to do, there's two factors. One is I've been sort of struggling with the balance between the two, but I'll mention them both, and I'll talk about which struggle a little bit. But one is the opposition to NATO enlargement, and just this idea that Ukraine, or really any former Soviet state, should be part of the Western alliance structure is kind of a anathema. And see, you know, because there is this belief in this sphere of influence division of Europe or the world into zones that permeates Russian strategic thinking, and I think Putin's thinking as well. So that's one. And two is this aspect that's kind of, it is a form of imperialism. It's not as straightforward as reconstituting the Russian Empire, but this idea that Ukraine is small Russia, or, you know, New Russia or whatever, you know, there's different words, you know, the old 19th century word was Malorossiya, which is Small Russia, or, you know, we've also heard Novorossiya, which is New Russia. But it's basically that it's closely related to Russia, and therefore it's unnatural from that point of view for Ukraine to be pursuing closer relations with the West and be hostile to Russia. And so it's like, so I think it's a combination of those two things. I initially really thought it was more the first and less the second, but you know, Putin has this tendency to actually say and write what he thinks. And he's been saying and writing things about how Ukraine isn't a real country for the last, you know, year or so. And so, which leads me to think that we should take that seriously, you know, because a lot of the other things he said, he's enacted on so over time. So that, I'm not quite sure of the balance of those two things. I think it's a combination of them, but I think that's what's driving this.
It's that old cliche that when somebody tells you who they are, believe them. It's
yes.
Read what they say, and then, you know, disprove its spin. I think part of that, you know, sometimes people will take domestic American political perspectives and habits and try to spot weld it on other nations and global leaders. And nope, some people are pretty straightforward with what they think, and it's actually what they think, not their speechwriter.
Yeah, and I remember this, you know, going back to like 2014 when. And I was at, you know, I was going to some of these conferences, these official events in Moscow where like the MOD would organize international security conferences and that sort of thing back then. And they were talking about, you know, this U.S. strategy for, you know, regime change and how they were, you know, the CIA sets up protests and then uses that as an excuse to, you know, for military intervention if the protests don't work by themselves, that sort of thing. And I was thinking, they don't actually believe this, right? This is propaganda. And then, you know, and they'd been really saying those kinds of things to some extent since back 2004, you know, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. But then they got more attention after the Arab Spring and the protests in Russia in 2012, they started getting more prominent in the Russian discourse. And as I was sitting there listening, you know, at these conferences, listening to all these people talking about that and talking about the strategies they were developing to counter this kind of thing, I realized that, no, wait a minute, they actually do believe this and they're acting on it and they're responding to it. You know, we may think it's some crazy conspiracy theory, but they're building out their strategy based on this. So there's a history there.
And it's sometimes you want to, you know, kind of like along the lines you were discussing, where you want to go, well, they're just exaggerating a bit. But at least from what I've seen, the rhetoric since the invasion that's come out, you know, hyper-nationalism is one thing, but some of the verbiage towards Ukraine and Ukrainians is almost eliminationist, along the lines of, you know, not really being a country. And before 2014 especially, but even before this latest invasion, you know, there's a non-zero percentage of the Ukrainian population that, if not pro-Russia, was accommodationist with Russia. And along the lines with the ratcheting language coming out of some of the parts of Russia, as they obviously have been frustrated with their first plan during the invasion. And I always have to remind myself to be careful, because a lot of what we see here in the U.S. is Ukrainian-centric, for lack of a better phrase. But as long as you know that, I think it's okay to read it. But you could see the natural hardening of the Ukrainians and their view of themselves and as a nation. And I think we both have seen, it's kind of a tell for people that are, you know, not young little kids like you and I are, but perhaps a little older, when you still see some of the people talk about the Ukraine, which growing up it was called, everybody called it the Ukraine. Nobody just called it Ukraine. So what are your thoughts about, regardless of how this winds up, that this experience is almost a galvanizing transition phase for Ukrainians and how they see themselves and their nations relative to that historical connection that they have to the Russians?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if we go back to, again, before 2014, what we saw is a very politically evenly divided country where the politics were divided along kind of the same axis as the linguistic divisions. So there was a sizable, you know, around half the population that was predominantly Russian speaking. Now, most of them thought of themselves as Ukrainians, not as Russians, but they were, but they spoke Russian at home and so forth, right? And a lot of those people tended to vote for more pro-Russian politicians as well. And you have this kind of, if you look back at like those first 25 years or so of Ukrainian independent history post-Soviet Union, you see this kind of alternation a lot of the time where, you know, more pro-Western presidents would be followed by more pro-Russian ones, and it kind of went back and forth. Well, that all, and Yanukovych, right, who was the president and who was overthrown in 2014, was one of the pro-Russian ones. And so, but the Russian response was to basically foreclose that as a political option in Ukraine going forward for two reasons. The basic one is that they invaded, right, and a lot of the people who were kind of more, some percentage, a significant percentage of the people who were more sympathetic to Russia changed their positions because, you know, even if you kind of feel some sympathy for Russia, if they're invading your country and taking parts of your territory, you're going to turn against them. And then the other was just the sort of the geographic population aspect, which is by annexing Crimea, which was one of the more pro-Russian regions, they changed the demographics so that it would be, you know, between the Crimea and then the Donbass republics, it became almost impossible, even if there hadn't been that political change among a part of the population, it would have been demographically almost impossible for a pro-Russian candidate to win, just because that they lost several million potential voters, basically, and especially in Crimea. So that kind of was already, you know, a shift where you saw even like, Poroshenko, you know, the first post 2014 election had a very anti-Russian president, Poroshenko. And then Zelensky, who was seen as more perhaps more accommodating to Russia. And again, there was this belief that he would be because he was a Russian speaker primarily. But then when he was actually in office, it turned out he wasn't so pro-Russian at all, because that, you know, that was not a viable path to political success in Ukraine post-2014.
As this thing has unrolled, many people are surprised by the performance of the Russian military. Are you surprised at their performance? If you are surprised, what has been the most surprising?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all were a bit. It sort of shows you the importance, is a general point, right, in terms of military planning, that you need to have a good strategy and you need to have, you know, morale and those kinds of things. And those are very hard to read off of, you know, Excel spreadsheets or whatever, right? So, you know, we saw the Russian military capabilities. We saw that they had much better weapons, that they were better organized since the reform began, that they had, the soldiers had better equipment, you know, personal equipment, better food and so forth. And we thought, okay, well, they've made a modern army. They're going to be able to fight really well. But what happens is if you have a strategy that is built on assumptions that you're going to, you know, capture Ukraine, you know, capture the capital in 2 days and your opponent's leadership will run away. And so you kind of start building out from that you make a lot of mistakes in terms of strategic planning, not just strategic, but also just like basic logistics and things like that. So not enough supplies brought in because they thought the operation wouldn't last very long, fighting on a lot. I mean, Ukraine is other than Russia, it's the largest country in Europe, right? And in territorial terms, and they were fighting on, you know, from five different directions without sufficient coordination among those different, you know, forces. We expected, I think, a lot more of kind of that they had borrowed from the U.S. this idea of, you know, kind of soften up the target with long range strikes to, you know, destroy their, you know, air defenses, air force, key control nodes and so forth. And then launch a ground invasion. But they didn't do that. They launched a few strikes and started the ground invasion the same day. So they never achieved air superiority, which turned out to be a big problem for them. They didn't, you know, they weren't coordinating and they didn't have enough logistics for a fight that lasted longer than a couple of weeks. And the morale aspect, they never really told their soldiers what they were doing or why they were doing it. And so people weren't sure why they were fighting, or they, you know, in some cases they didn't even know they were, until they went into Ukraine, they thought they were on exercises, right? So all those things together made it kind of a mess. And then once you start, you know, and then there's kind of path dependence, you know. The Ukrainians saw that they were, the Ukrainian military saw they were performing better than they thought they would in terms of resistance. The Russians were performing worse, and so the Ukrainians developed more and more confidence, whereas the Russians got bogged down. And so we ended up where we did. Now what they're doing now is they're kind of trying to adjust. So they're building up a unified command. They're building up, they're just focusing on one direction. They're bringing in more reinforcements and logistics. The problem for them is that a lot of their most capable units have now been damaged. Some are no longer combat capable. So there's this balance where the Russian side they have a lot of equipment. They have a lot of munitions. They're a bit short on manpower, and that's a problem for them. Whereas the Ukrainians have the opposite problem. They have all sorts of volunteers. They know exactly what they're doing. They're fighting, you know, in terms of morale, they're fighting for their homeland after all. So they have a lot of people, but they don't have enough equipment or ammunition and so forth. So it's kind of a race for them to try to bring in more from the West, to equip all the potential volunteers and so forth, and try to equalize while the Russians, if they take more casualties, they don't have that much in the way of manpower to replace those units that, you know, are exhausted.
Yeah, I think that's one of the, everybody's always looking for takeaways, and this is still a young war, and it's clearly going to age one way or another. And you touched on it a little bit there, as big takeaway is the assumptions that you make. It was obvious that the Russian general staff and Putin, they delivered to him what he wanted to hear, which was a quick war. And, you know, that was signaled when they tried to take, you know, the Anatol International Airport at Hostomel, just wasting their paratroopers in that attack like they did. Obviously thinking that the Ukrainians would collapse and they'd be able to do that decapitation strike and they'd have a quick war. But that clearly hasn't happened. And it speaks to, and this, people need to be careful, you know, throwing too many dispersions at the Russians, because this is not a problem unique to them, that if you have a culture that it's hard to be direct, objective, and to speak uncomfortable truths about readiness, that you can talk yourself into doing things. And it really seems to me an elite failure. But with this one point, and that's when a lot of people, I think, you know, rightfully, with the retreating of the forces out of the north, it looks like the Russians have done in a few weeks what we did in the first few months of World War II, is we fired the poorly performing people and then found the people we may not have liked, but maybe have some better ideas and better performance, and are putting them into place. Are you seeing, when you talk about learning institutions, and part of learning an institution being a learning institution is knowing when you're failing. Are you seeing in some of those moves that the Russians are doing that they have taken that objective point of view, and regardless of what they thought they were going to do at the beginning of the war, now that they're in one, they're learning, and people should take a deep breath as the soil firms up in the east of the country?
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I'll add is that it wasn't just like, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, bad intelligence or bad advice being given to the leadership but you know, the U.S. intelligence kind of felt similarly. They also thought the Ukrainian wouldn't be able to stand up to the Russians. So,
sure did.
You know, it wasn't just them, with completely out to lunch assumptions. It was kind of conventional wisdom, right? It's just that the Ukrainians actually, you know, it turns out that things that are not easy to quantify, like morale, actually matter a lot. And so from that, so I just wanted to add that, because I think it's important to keep that in mind. As for the learning, yeah, I think that's exactly what they're doing. So now there's the question of whether that adaptation is sufficient to because now to change the tide, I guess, for the Russians, because what they're, like I said, some of their most capable units are no longer available, so they're kind of scurrying around looking for manpower. And you know that if they're bringing in people who've been largely serving as peacekeepers, or, you know, glorified peacekeepers, at least in places like Abkhazia, you know, South Ossetia, Transnistria, and they're sending them over to the front lines in the Donbass, that those aren't your first choice troops, most likely. How that develops, and they're also now fighting against some of the more capable units of the Ukrainian military, because the Donbass units in the Ukrainian military are the ones that have been fighting this war for the last 8 years. And so those are also some of the better units vis-a-vis, you know, some of the more the less experienced, let's say, units that were stationed in some of the other locations in Ukraine. So we'll see. You know, I think that they've clearly declared, you know, internally they've decided on a more limited set of objectives for the moment, at least, and they're no longer aiming at, you know, Kiev or probably even Odessa. But they really do want to to consolidate control of the East. And whether they achieve that or not, I think the next few weeks will decide. There's been a lot of talk that, you know, Russia would really like to have some kind of something to present to the people as a victory before, May 9th, the traditional victory in Europe, World War II celebrations that they have, so that they could, you know, march with march with honor, as it were, at the big parade.
Well, that was one of the questions I was going to ask, is that when the U.S. pulls out of places like Vietnam, we declare victory and move out. But we're, you know, Vietnam was a long way from our border. And can the Russians, can Putin, can somebody say, okay, we've now won what we want? If they get Donbass and I can't remember the name of the other province over there, but they're interested in. Yeah, is that, yeah, thank you. Is that enough, do you think? Or do you think that no matter what he does, I mean, a lot of people are saying that Putin has no, God, I hate to use the word, but off-ramp, he's got no good alternative. If he wins this limited thing, but it's cost him an arm and a leg and lives and certainly a reputation, plus, you know, not to mention all the war crime allegations and all that stuff, is there a good place for him to say we've won and glory be to us and then we'll have our May 9th parade?
Absolutely, because remember, the official for domestic audiences, right, for Russian domestic audiences, the whole operation, you know, they have this whole thing where it's not a war, it's a special military operation, and the purpose is to free the Donbass. So that was the official declaration. And so if they end up freeing the Donbass, you know, they've kind of already dropped the other part of that, some of those early speeches in February were, you know, denazification of Ukraine, which was interpreted as, okay, replacing the, you know, the legitimate government of Ukraine with, you know, some kind of pro-Russia puppet sort of regime. But that's been kind of drop now in the rhetoric, and so the focus is really on the Donbass. And so if they can actually quote unquote liberate the Donbass, they can certainly declare that a victory. Now the costs are obvious to us in terms of economic damage, internal repression and all that, but you know, from the Russian perspective, that can, you know, there's a sort of a regime consolidation aspect to it as well, where, you know, they can continue on the, you know, spinning the line that the West is against us and they're trying to destroy us and we have to all unite and work together to save the country from the evil, you know, Americans and Germans or whatever. And so I think that'll be, you know, if they can get something that they can turn into a victory, they will spin the rest of the hardship that way, and also continue repressions internally, because, you know, calling everyone who's pro-Western, you know, a traitor and that sort of thing. Oh, still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I think Sal forgot to turn his microphone on. let's follow up on that a little bit, because the internal, and you know a lot more about this, obviously, than I do, but how is he? He's got total control of the internal media of Russia, and it seems, and he certainly has been cracking down on dissenters who do know that they don't want to be in this war. Is there any way for people to talk to rally against Putin at some point, or is this pretty much a foregone conclusion? He'll be around for a long time.
I think that political dissent at this point is very difficult, and effective political dissent is pretty impossible. You know, we're seeing people who are, you know, being arrested for, you know, holding little signs. You know, I think, you know, each one sort of crazier than the last. You know, there was one that was, you know, something about, you know, there was a sign that said I'm against fascism or something, and the person was arrested for discrediting the Russian army or, you know, or that sort of thing. But what I do see, the potential danger and this will take, you know, a bit of time to manifest, is the economic side, right? Where people, if the economy, you know, as is being forecast, really does collapse because of the sanctions, then you end up with possibility that people protest, not for any political reasons, but just because they want their salaries and they want their living standards. And so you could have that be a point of weakness for the regime. But I think that the repressive apparatus now is so kind of well-honed that I think they will handle that most likely. And so I do think that this regime is, you know, I mean, assuming, you know, Putin's health and so forth, because, you know, there are always rumors that he's sick, and you know, I don't know how much credence to give them, but I think that there's really no way back at this point in terms of, you know, as long as Putin is in charge, there's no way for any kind of off-ramp in terms of relations with the West, right? Like, it's, you know, all the things, you know, all the war crimes and all of the baggage that Putin now has in any relationship with the West just make it impossible for any kind of normalization of relations to occur as long as he's in charge. But if he's not in charge, if someone who's also, you know, potentially quite hardline comes in, but just kind of, you know, the turning of a leaf, right? And we saw this in the Soviet days where, you know, Stalin died and then, you know, someone as unlikely as Beria, who was his, you know, secret police leader and conducted a lot of the repressions, initially tried to, you know, be the liberalizer and tried to, nobody else in the Politburo trusted him, so they got rid of him, and then Khrushchev actually did pursued that liberalizing course, but it was originally Beria's idea. And so you could have, and Khrushchev was still a communist and still, you know, kept control domestically, but there, you know, after some, there was domestic liberalization eventually after, you know, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was some normal efforts at normalization of relations with the West as well. So there's a possibility that, you know, kind of whether it's generational turnover or some other mechanism, you know, once Putin's off the scene, you know, down the road, whether that's in 1 or 2 years or in 10 years or who knows, that's, I think, when you have the possibility of some normalization.
Well, I think Sal's trying to talk, but I can't hear him.
Yeah, I can't either.
Yeah. Well, he's confused. Apparently, his OFF switch is stuck or something. Someone has suggested that I think it was Stephen Kotkin says the Cold War never ended, and that the Western world made some serious mistakes in thinking that it had ended. Is that a line of thought that you would pursue as being legitimate? Did we make enough mistakes that we messed up somewhere along the line?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think both sides have made lots of mistakes, right? Like, I don't know if I may not agree with Kotkin and with Steve on the specific mistakes, right? I think that there were opportunities in the 90s to create a different relationship with Russia that might have worked out. You know, no definites about it, right? But there were possibilities. There were, you know, we might have done more to, you know, see, I sort of think the other direction. Like, we might have done more to try to actually incorporate Russia into some of the Western institutions. It would have been very difficult, I know. But you know, there were, I think when Yeltsin was president, there was definitely a desire to build a new relationship. but you know, we, I think then, you know, when Putin came in, there was maybe a lack of appreciation, and I'll cop to this one as well for myself, you know, a lack of appreciation of his nature maybe. And so people continued, you know, the Western governments continued to sort of think in terms of partnerships long after that was no longer really in the cards. And I don't think, and I wouldn't say that Putin was never open to a partnership with the U.S. or with the West. I think he was early on, the first couple of years. But it was really, you know, somewhere between the Iraq War and the Orange Revolution was when it kind of started, you know, Putin kind of decided that, you know, that wasn't the direction to go in. And it took us probably, you know, 10 years until, you know, we excused largely the Georgia War. So it wasn't really until Crimea that the Western leaders really realized that we were dealing with a renewed adversarial relationship.
Well, I think I've found my alternative communication means. I assume you can hear me now.
Yes, excellent.
Perfect. Before I had my little communications issues, the joys of live radio, we were talking about the upcoming anniversary of the end of the Second World War. And one of the interesting reports that I saw earlier at the end of last week, actually, was they were going through the parts of Bucha, northwest of Kiev, that the Russians had retreated from. And they were at a local, looked like a high school, that the Russians were based out of. And before the Ukrainians left, in that high school, they had a museum of the Second World War. And they had put a note on there, you know, stay out of this room. And the Russians who were based out of there said, we'll leave it alone. And they did. And, you know, that's part of their shared history of that Second World War. And, you know, we're talking about Putin and his mindset. And you look at, you know, 2022's unlikely leader of Zelensky, where you kind of got a flavor when you said early on, because you mentioned the intel failure in the West was significant, where, you know, the United States, before the invasion even took place, evacuated the embassy from Kiev, went west, and they offered – it's interesting. Many times people will tell you about their personality, about what they assume others will do. And they offered Zelensky to, you know, evacuate, and he said, I don't need a ride, I need ammunition. So if the Russians are trying to position back to getting an agreement in the East with the Ukrainians, are we assuming too much that the Ukrainians, who seem to have a little bit of a bone in their teeth right now, if they have the momentum on their back, that they might be resistant if that situation does develop where the Russians are willing to come to a negotiated end?
Yeah, well, I think we'll see. I think a lot will depend on how this next fight, you know, the second phase goes and how the fighting goes there. Because what, you know, international relations literature and military theory and so forth, you know, they always talk about that, you know, ceasefires become possible when there's a hurting stalemate, right? That, you know, when both sides realize that they're going to be worse off later than they are now. And not just that they will be worse off, but that they realize it. And so, as you know, what we saw in the early, in phase one, let's say, was a situation where the Russians thought were underperforming, and the Ukrainians were overperforming. So the Ukrainians felt like they could be better off later, so they didn't want to settle. The Russians, although they were underperforming, were continuing to gain some territory, especially in, you know, in the south and the east, so they didn't want to settle. And so, you know, a lot of those negotiations that, you know, didn't really pan out because neither side was really ready to make to make the sacrifices that would be necessary. And I think that it's possible that we'll continue in that situation as long as long as neither side is definitively if one side is definitively winning or the whichever side it is, they might not be ready to the losing side might be ready to settle, but the winning side won't. So it's really when you get down to a point where they get bogged down and neither side can really feel they can advance, that's when you start seeing the possibility of a ceasefire. I'm not sure that, there was talk, the last negotiations that I got a lot of attention were the ones in Turkey, and there was right before the Bucha massacre got, in the news, and there was talk that, one of the parts of the agreement would be the Russian withdrawal to the pre-invasion lines of control. And that sort of made me wonder, like why would the Russians agree to that right now? They control all this extra territory. I think an armistice line kind of settlement would be more to their liking than the alternative, unless they think they're going to start losing, which I don't think they think at the moment. So yeah, but on the other, the other side is, I think that the Western leaders have all made clear that they're not going to force Zelensky into a settlement he doesn't want. So it's going to be up to the Ukrainians to decide what kind of concessions they're actually willing to make.
What impact do you think the Western sanctions, which we seem to be ratcheting up increasingly, are having? And who's most affected by those? The population, the oligarchs, the corrupt officials. I mean, so much seems to have been made of the some of the deficiencies in the Russian most modern equipment due to what appears to be a rather corrupt acquisition system. But let's focus on the sanctions being imposed. Is this going to have a major effect on Russia? Have they got other markets they can turn to get rid of their most valuable assets, the oil and gas and whatever other valuables they have?
Well, I think that clearly they are having an effect, and they're having an effect, unlike maybe previous rounds, 2014 sanctions or whatever, they're having an effect really across the board. So, oligarchs don't like having their yachts seized and, the realization that they can't go to France anymore or wherever. And at the same time, the people are finding that they can no longer buy, a whole range of products, including, you could maybe consider luxury goods, certain Western fashion or, cell phones and things, but also some very basic things my understanding is a lot of the dog food in Russia was imported, right? Or paper, printer paper, was mostly imported. So there are shortages of paper in Russia. And those are temporary things. They'll pay things like paper. They can, start making on their own over time. But there are other things that are much harder to make up, like advanced semiconductors, right? Chipsets are, most of the world, it turns out, is dependent on, one company in Taiwan to make the most advanced chips. And so a lot of that has goes for both civilian production, but also for a lot of the military. A lot of the advanced tanks and, different, aircraft and so forth all use these imported components. Now, a lot of when they were doing import substitution after 2014, and there were a lot of reports about how successful this was and how, 80% of the components of, weapon X or item Y or whatever it is were domestically produced, well, that's great. But if the remaining 5% or 20% are a thing that is required to make the tank run like a chip, and you don't have any ability to make it domestically, that's going to cause your tank factory to shut down, as Ural, and as happened at Ural Vagon Zavod, in the last month. So how they deal with that, I think, is an open question, because I don't think they have good alternatives. And the Chinese, they can maybe buy Chinese alternatives, but they're not as good as what they're replacing.
And that's one of the big known unknowns, is regardless of how this war winds up, is how do you unwind all the sanctions, and perhaps, especially in Germany, even more importantly, is the staying power of a change in attitude towards doing business with Russia. Because at the end of the day, per capita GDP, even for a people who have such a distinguished history of suffering and deprivation as the Russian people, it still matters when your neighbors just across the border have an order of magnitude greater ability than you do. And especially that relationship with Germany in the energy sector really was impressive up to the point of this year, when at least indications are that the Germans will start unwinding. Outside of China, where do you see options Russia may look at if those things harden, those feelings harden in Germany? I know that the former Warsaw Pact and the Baltic Republics, they have just been reinforced with their attitude towards doing business with Russia. That economic stress, really, if you're looking long-term beyond the conflict, that's something that is going to be a challenge for Russia to unwind, you think?
Yeah. And I think, but there are, if you look at the countries that have implemented sanctions, it's, some people say, well, it's just the West. It's broader than just the West, but it's not everybody, right? So you have some, countries like, Taiwan, I mentioned, South Korea, Japan, right? It's not the West traditionally conceived, at least, so that have implemented sanctions. But at the same time, you have gaps, right? I mean, other than China, there's also, important countries like India, Brazil, Israel, Turkey, right, that haven't really implemented sanctions, most of the Middle Eastern countries. So that's where they're going to look for alternative markets. The problem is it depends on which goods, right? So if it's something like oil, well, oil is pretty, fungible. You put it, you put it on a tanker and you can send it off somewhere. So what we're seeing right now is the Russian oil is selling at a discount because there aren't as many buyers for it. But, they can still, given that the prices of oil went up dramatically, they can still get a pretty good profit on it. But something like natural gas, you need pipelines. You can only do so much LNG, and even then with LNG, you can only sell it to countries that have LNG receiving terminals on their end, right? So that's not a thing that's very flexible. So there was talk of, we're going to build a pipeline to Pakistan now. Well, that's going to take a long time. And it's not clear that, a lot of the pipeline building technologies also, depend on imports and foreign companies that may not be willing to do business with Russia at the moment. What I think caught the Russian leadership by surprise was, to some extent, the breadth and depth of the sanctions, yes. But even more so, the sort of what they've started calling the West canceling Russia. But what it is that the reputation costs for Western companies but just multinational companies, let's say from a whole host of countries, of doing business in Russia, came to be seen as unacceptable, right? So when people started publishing lists of these are the companies that are still staying in Russia, a lot of companies said, oh, we better not stay in Russia then. And so you see things like, you know, companies that had really invested a lot in the Russian business, like McDonald's, for example, IKEA, pulling out. Not because they're required to by government sanctions, but because of the reputation costs. And I think that was something that the Russian leadership really didn't expect.
I think one of the other things that have been of interest is that reports of sort of a brain drain out of Russia. Have you heard any more about that and what the effect of that would be on the Russians?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, there's a variety of types of people, right? So a lot of people in social science type, you know, have left just because they don't see a future of them for themselves in Russia, even though they're not necessarily sure, you know, how they'll, you know, what they'll do in the West, because, you know, if you're a literature professor, or, you know, you teach sociology or something like that, you're not necessarily going to get a position in the West. But then there's a lot of, you know, tech and IT specialists who can, you know, who the vast majority of them are very much fluent in English and can work for, you know, coding is, you know, largely coding. They were, many of them were already working for Western companies who, you know, either had offices in Russia or in some cases more recently even remotely entirely. And so they can, you know, adapt pretty quickly and, you know, move to a variety of countries, you know, some in Israel, some in, you know, places like Armenia or Uzbekistan, right? But they can continue to work for Western companies wherever they happen to be. And this is going to, yes, it's definitely going to be a serious negative impact on Russia's tech industry, which is really, you know, I mean, if you, tech industry is really driving a lot of innovation, economic innovation around the world right now. And if you're not on that train, then you're going to have problems in terms of economic growth for the, you know, kind of medium to long term.
Well, Dmitry, we're coming near the end of the hour. Really appreciate you taking time to join us. For the listener, if they wanted to keep track of you and your friends over at CNA and the work y'all are doing, you know, not necessarily on this exact conflict, but y'all do a lot of the big pixel work and monitoring of a lot of the Russian media, that if you don't speak Russian, you're going to have trouble getting the closed captioning to work. And I would recommend everybody go over to the Dmitry's Russ Mill website. There's great links there to the Russia media analysis y'all been doing on a regular basis since March.
Yeah, but since October. We started in October. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah, we started that in October and comes out every 2 weeks. We're taking a little break right now, but it should be back, you know, by the end of April. We should resume it. So yeah, that's a great resource. We're also doing a lot of we're tracking. Russian work on artificial intelligence. We were talking about the tech industry, so that's something that one of my colleagues has had a project, ongoing project, looking at that. We'll be doing more reports. You know, as things develop, we'll be doing more reports on Russian military performance in this war as well.
Excellent. Well, again, I really appreciate you coming on today, and look forward to having you on again.
Absolutely. Glad, great to be here, and we have a long history now.
Yes, sir.
It's been great. Thank you, Dmitry.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. And until next time, hope you all have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Molly wrote on me to reply to Iris. Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.